This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 447 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I talk to the historian Candace Taylor. So I'm recording this intro on the Friday, which in a normal year would see me driving from Orlando down to Miami, where I would spend the next 2 days interviewing as many people as I can during Miami Book Fair. If you tuned in last week, then you know that Miami Book Fair is online this year because, well, you know why. And today's interview is one of my Miami Book Fair interviews for this year. So let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
Right now, it is my honor to be talking to Candace Taylor, author of Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me.
Well, thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
So in a lot of ways, this book hits so many sweet spots for me, even though I really wish The Green Book or a history of The Green Book weren't necessary. You know, this is a kind of a travelogue of you visiting as many places that appeared in the Green Book, some of which are miraculously still in operation, which I just found so inspiriting. But it's also, you know, there's some memoir elements where you talk about your family's history and stories that you've heard, as well as just a very thorough history of the Green Book and how it was put together. And also, this isn't a coffee table book, but there are so many reproduced photographs and illustrations so that, you know, the publisher, I think, did just an amazing job of putting the book together. Normally, you know, a history book, I get the feeling like they reluctantly put some photographs in there, but it's not on thick enough paper. And, you know, you can sort of see the words bleeding through. Mm-hmm. And this book, you know, when I'm reading it, I can smell the fresh ink and it's just intoxicating and the book is beautiful. So I like to just make a whole lot of observations and then throw a question mark at the end and see how my guests do. But did you know that you would have this much support from the publisher in terms of putting together the visual elements of the book?
Well, that's a good question. I, you know, and it became a big issue for me because when I was with my agent and we were selling the book. We had several publishers interested, which was obviously a dream because this is my third book. And I know that that's not always the case that you get that much interest. And it was soon after Trump had been elected too, which I think helped the agency around. We need to, you know, we want to have our hands on this material. So when I went into Abrams, the publisher, I had had four other publishers scheduled that day, four or five other meetings I was having that day. And I remember going in thinking, you know, and I told my agent, I said, you know, I think we're going to have to let Abrams down easy because I had just left this other publisher that, and I really liked the editor there. And I thought this is, you know, that's who I want to go with. And I was nervous because Abrams is this great art book publisher and they make these really beautiful art books. And I thought this isn't an art book. There's going to be illustrations and I definitely want it to be visual, but this isn't an art book because I wanted it to be taken seriously. And I thought if it was too pretty,
yeah,
people wouldn't take it seriously. You know, so when I went in, it was one of those moments where everything I thought to be true wasn't. And they presented me with a 17-page proposal of their vision for this project. And it was so incredibly...
The publisher proposed your book to you.
Yes. My head almost spun around. I thought, what universe is this as an author? I mean, this never happens. And so, you know, and I said very clearly in that meeting, I said, it has to have a certain trim size. Mm-hmm. I had all these demands that I thought they were going to be like, yeah, whatever. You know, I just didn't, but I said, yeah, it has to be a certain trim size. I need it to sit next to books like The New Jim Crow. It cannot be an oversized, you know, glossy, pretty book. I want at least, you know, 80,000 words of text. I want to be very text heavy. I need real oversight and true, you know, fact checking, because I knew I was dealing with this incredibly long history that it was going to be very difficult for me to I just knew this wasn't the book they normally did, the type of book they normally did. And they convinced me in that meeting because, you know, after this book is out there, we're publishing a children's book for ages 9 to 12 based on this manuscript. And they do children's books. They have a great rapport and a great history of doing wonderful children's books. So I just, you know, because they were so committed to the project, because they were, you know, they gave me this proposal, I was so floored and so inspired by their inspiration. I thought, you know, yes, obviously I didn't make the decision that day, but I left thinking, wow, my mind is blown. And once, you know, I finished the book, I helped pick the designers. They gave me a list of designers they were looking at, and I got to be part of that process. I probably looked at 17 different book covers that I all rejected. And they were like, they bent over backwards. And I'm not a diva, but I definitely, you know, I have opinions. And I think my agent describes me as somebody who, you know, I'm not a prima donna, but I definitely have opinions and therefore a reason, and I'm particular. And we were a good fit. I mean, my experience with Abrams has been incredible. Like you said, they produce this beautiful book. I had no idea when you're dealing with so many different types of imagery, even with the PDFs, I thought I was happy with it. I fought for those full bleeds of the pages, the green book pages. Mm-hmm. I wanted you to feel like you were in the green book. But when I got to the point where, you know, it actually became a thing and I got it delivered to me, I still didn't know if it was going to look good. I thought, you know, it might be too messy. There may be too many different types of images and colors and these Technicolor, you know, postcards with these archival black and white images with these, you know, with my photographs of these green book sites that are modern. It could have looked very messy. And the brilliance of, you know, the designers and Abrams, you know, they really, it turned out really nice. And I'm so thankful and so grateful that I've had a really good ally and relationship with them.
Well, it seems to me like this is a hybrid text and also the visuals are a hybrid. And so the publisher, I think, did very well, yeah, in sort of blending them in a way that is dynamic without it looking like it might be undermining the writing which it doesn't do.
It's like it has to be designed, but not over-designed, you know, and that happens a lot when you're dealing with that, those so many different elements that have to kind of work together. It can look too precious, and it doesn't. It just really is a unique book. I mean, my background, my master's degree is in visual criticism that I got almost 20 years ago. So it's been a while, but my background, you know, I've always been an artist my whole life. And, you know, obviously I'm a photographer, but I knew that it really did encapsulate what my degree was about, which was showing very complicated elements and history, but presenting it in a really easy way to access, you know, an accessible manner that it didn't complicate it so much, but the themes and the ideas are complicated. So trying to make it look easy is the hardest thing to do. And that's what, you know, Abrams really helped me with as well. So it was, a really great experience.
And if I'm not mistaken, right, part of the impetus of the book, it was hearing stories from your uncle who had these rituals for travel, which you didn't understand, and you didn't understand why he was so fanatical about them. And then realizing the historical context for that gave you a personal way into history.
Well, yeah, actually, it was my stepfather. His name is Ron, and I'd known him, God, since I was like 12. You know, I was in my 40s when I started this, you know, my mid-40s when I started this project. Well, I started this project in 2013, and it's been a real journey because Ron, you know, we've always gotten along, but he was always the big Marine, you know, very lots of testosterone, masculine,
tough guy.
Tough guy. And I always, you know, he intimidated every boyfriend I ever had. He was always but he's a big teddy bear too. And most people just didn't see that part of him. But he grew up in the Jim Crow South. And he had a lot of scars from that time. And I don't think he ever shared them with me. I never knew. He used to tell me stories all the time. And he talked forever about all kinds of stuff. But it wasn't until I started this project that he started telling me these kinds of stories. Like, you know, the chauffeur's hat, the way that I opened the book is literally him at the age of 7 in the backseat of his car, his parents' car. And they're driving north. And they run into a sheriff, you know, pulls him over. And his father, you know, says, don't say a word. And Ron had no idea what was going on. And they were just being pulled over. Who knows why? But the sheriff said, you know, is this your car? Who are these people with you? You know, where are you going? And his father pretended not to know them, his own family, and said, you know, this is not my car. This is my employer's car. She's the maid, when he looked at his wife. And said, that's her son, and I'm driving them home. And that was the first time, you know, Ron had no idea what was going on. And the police said, you know, well, where's your hat? Meaning the chauffeur's hat. And his father said, it's hanging in the back, officer. And there was always that black chauffeur's hat hanging behind, you know, in the back seat. And Ron never knew what that was or why it was there. He just always saw it. And so the sheriff said, waved him on and said, you know, go ahead. And they got out of that okay, but it was very difficult, you know, reality, I think, for Ron to witness. And ever since, he said he would, every other nice car he rode in, a black man's car, they always had a chauffeur's hat. It was kind of this prop and this ruse that people used. And so there were stories like that that I was reading in the archives that I thought, really, is this true? And I could go to Ron and say, hey, you know, tell me what you know about this. And sometimes, almost always, he'd have a personal story connected to it. So he became kind of my guardian angel through the project. He died literally the week I started writing the book, which was devastating to me because we had become so close in those, you know, few years of me doing the research. And I spent so many months on the road and I just talked to Ron on these long drives. So it was really heartbreaking and devastating when he died. And originally he wasn't supposed to be in the book. He was a pretty private man, so I don't think I ever would have really written these stories. I mean, he didn't tell me anything that was, you know, necessarily private, but I don't think I would have put him in the book in the way that he is had he not passed. And that week when I was supposed to be writing the book, I only had 8 months to turn in the manuscript, and I was completely overwhelmed. with a workload. And I called my agent and I said, all I can do is write Ron's stories. I'm just sitting here crying every morning and I'm just writing his stories. And I said, I know I'm supposed to be writing the book, but I think I'm going to open the book with Ron's story about the chauffeur's hat. And she said, just keep going. And within a couple of weeks, I realized that all of those stories were touchstones for almost every chapter in the book. So that's how Ron becomes this narrative thread in the book. It was, again, another, I guess, just meant to be. I had no plan to do that.
Well, one of the things the book illustrates is, you know, it offers testimony to a lot of the phenomena that a lot of white America doesn't know exists, or they'd rather not think about it. And so I found these stories, like I've heard the short version of some of these things before, but you know, the richness of the Green Book and the way it was used and the way it was built by Victor Green, you know, I just felt like this history felt a lot both more personal to me, but also, you know, I could feel the tendrils of this book attaching to other areas that I know about in American history and in African American history. In a way, you know, the book is written so that it's fun, or as fun as it can be, and it moves along. I mean, sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's tragic, but it moves along. And you know, you had mentioned earlier the difficulty of, you know, making all the pieces fit so that they don't look like you had to fit them together. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that process of figuring out, you know, how to combine the history with these personal stories, and also the struggle of just trying to find enough research, which that terrifies me about writing history and nonfiction, is just worrying, will the information be there when I go to look?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite involved because, you know, I'd done two fellowships right before I really, in 2016 and 2017, I did a fellowship at the Schomburg Center, which was literally where all the Green Books are. They have the largest collection in the world. And there were, I think they've digitized 24 editions now online. So it's a great resource. If you type in NYPL Green Book, you can look at their collection of Green Books. But I moved to New York and did the Schomburg Fellowship. And then I moved to Boston and did a fellowship at Harvard, the Hutchins Center with Henry Louis Gates Jr. And that was really a huge honor and incredible opportunity. But once I got out of that, I thought, well, okay, I've done all this great scholarly research and I have been able to find a lot of archival information. But the issue was, when I sold the book proposal to Abrams, it was a very different book. It was not the book that I ended up writing. And when I left Harvard, I hit the road. I was on the road pretty much for about total over the time I did the research, about almost 3 years of literally being on the road. I mean, my things were in storage in LA. I didn't have a home for a while. I just would live in hotels. I did make a pit stop in Bisbee, Arizona for a while. I rented out a hotel suite for, I don't know how many, like almost a year. Then I moved to Denver and I moved into an apartment, but my things were still in storage. I finally got things out of storage when I was towards the end of my Denver time. But I realized once I found all of these great, you know, I was doing the field research of these Green Book sites, and 80% of these sites were in traditional Black neighborhoods. And when I saw the condition of these neighborhoods, you know, I've been doing this work for over 20 years. I've been documenting different parts of, you know, different subcultures in America. I'm no fragile flower. I've seen a lot of different things. I'm not, you know, sensitive in any way. I'm a Black woman. I've been traveling on the road for decades now. But I still had not seen this level of poverty and violence ever. And when I went to Chicago, you know, this particular neighborhood in Chicago, I've been to Chicago 20 plus times in my life. Love the city. It's one of the best cities in the world. But I hadn't been to this neighborhood in Chicago where 53 people were shot the weekend I was there. And the irony of me looking back at historically at this guide that was supposed to keep Black folks safe, and I'm you know, it's 2016, 2017. I'm thinking, I'm afraid to leave my car. And it wouldn't it be ironic that Victor Green, the man who created the Green Book, would see me today capturing this kind of history and learning this reality. And I realized that it was a lot of the, it wasn't racism in the sense that we think of, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow South and all of these, you know, things that you identify with race. It was really governmental forces that shaped these communities. It was things like redlining and urban renewal and today gentrification and all of these things that keep manifesting themselves every 20 or 30 years. We keep doing the same things, and the devastation that's happened to these communities as a result of that, I thought, I cannot write this book without telling that story. And so when I finally landed in Bisbee and took a kind of a break, I was supposed to actually write the book in South Carolina, but all the hurricanes were happening and the place I rented wasn't, you know, it was just crazy. So I ended up kind of getting, it's a longer story, but I ended up settling in Bisbee for a while thinking I just need to sit and write. And I rewrote the proposal to Abrams. I said, you know, I know this wasn't the book that I sold to you, but let me rewrite the proposal. And if you agree, we can go with this book. If you don't, we'll go with the original idea. And they said, okay, sure. So I rewrote the proposal in that context. And that's how, you know, I got to this other level of storytelling, because I thought I really needed to trace the present into this history and contextualize the Green Book chronologically over the three decades it was in publication. It was in publication from 1936 to 67. So all these things happened with the pendulum of justice would swing forward and back. We've never just gotten better as a country in terms of race and fairness. It's, but yet we think of it, so many people would think, oh, it's 2016. Why are we still dealing with this? And it's like, well, history is reactionary. So I needed to tell that story. And one of the things I did when I finally got to Denver, because it was very unwieldy and it was a much more difficult book to write, the second one that I proposed. And there were times when I kicked myself and I thought, oh God, I wish I had just stuck to the original idea. It would have been so much easier. You know, I make things hard for myself. But I had a big pool table in this loft of the people who owned it, and they wouldn't move the pool table, and I got really irritated. I thought, you know, I have to push this thing in the corner. But I ended up using it to put all of these color-coded index cards and all these different threads, whether it was Ron's story, my, you know, travels, archival history, Green Book history, other quotes from people. They were all color-coded, and I could see chapter by chapter what was happening in the book. And I could see sometimes I'd written a chapter and neglected to mention the Green Book or something, you know, some like egregious problems. I thought, oh my God, thank God I have this system. But it was complicated. It was not an easy book to write, for sure.
Well, I love that they wouldn't move the billiard table. So you're like, all right, so now, this is now a writer's tool.
Right, exactly.
Felt. Turns out that's a great backdrop for index cards. All right.
Yeah.
I also, what I love about your story is, you know, like the new idea, even though it really challenged you, it was probably the much better idea.
Yeah, generally. I mean, I, you know, my mother always said I would find the hardest thing to do and I would choose, yeah, I'm going to do that. She would always say, you know, well, if you did it this way, it'd be easier. And I just never gravitated towards easy.
I'm trying to think, that might be something you and I have in common. I'm trying to think if it's something writers have in common. My master's thesis was on Ulysses because it was just the most interesting, weirdest thing I had come across. And it's like, you know, other people finished in a weekend and it took me.
Exactly. That's me.
Yeah. Over a year to figure out what I had to say about Ulysses.
Yeah. Well, sometimes but the rewards are much better, right? When you do actually pull it off and you get more of what you put into it, I guess.
I felt unstoppable after that. Like, okay, there's no book you go, ooh, this book will confuse you and you'll be scared. I'm like, I won't be scared. I might be confused. I won't be scared. Well, can you tell me a little bit about this system? Like, were you trying to make sure you had like cards covering each, you know, different components? Or was it just kind of storyboarding and seeing a great overview of the whole book and just seeing like you could focus in and go, okay, what's happening in this chapter?
Yeah.
Because I find it's so difficult, you know. I think that is the greatest challenge of book writing, is just seeing the structure and how all the components work towards the structure.
Right. Yeah. It was really, the color coding really helped. I mean, I still have so many, like, you know, packages of index cards left over that I didn't use because certain colors I'd only use so many of. But, you know, for instance, for Ron's stories, you know, they would be blue cards, and I'd write in Sharpie marker on the, like, the, you know, who it was, whether it was me, Ron, green book history, like the green cards were green book history. So I got so used to the colors that I could just see on the pool table. I'd just have it chapter by chapter, and almost to the, maybe every two or three paragraphs, I'd have a card for that material, but I could move it around. So it's like, if I had too many, you know, historical quotes and not enough green book, I could see really easily from across a room, like, there's not enough green in that chapter, because I had to keep sticking to the green book. But this history is so rich, and what each edition of the green book was representing as well, there were themes per chapter that I had to stick to. So it was a parallel thing where it was like, oh, I need, this is something that happened in the 1947, but, you know, it still had to also be tied to the theme that I needed to talk about at that point in the book. So it wasn't easy, because there were things that were, I really wanted to mention earlier on, but it didn't make sense chronologically. So the timing became a factor, you know, the subject became a factor, and then the balance of all these threads had to also intersect, so that you wouldn't lose a thread halfway through and then bring it up again and say, oh, what, you know, and disorient the reader. So I don't, and believe me, this system didn't really become apparent to me until more than halfway through the writing process, unfortunately. If I had started that, that would have been much better. But that, you know, it was like, once I figured it out, I was like, oh, thank God, this tool, I have it. But, you know, it would have helped 4 months ago.
Maybe you also needed to generate enough material so that it kind of had this critical mass and you had enough stuff where you could, I don't
see,
know, if you,
I'm trying to solve.
Yeah. If you said, well, I've got these four different colored, you know, of index cards, maybe that would have programmed too much.
Yeah. And I don't even think I understood what the problems were until later on. I guess it is what it is. It, you know, again, it just felt like, this would have been so much easier if I'd figured this out earlier. And then when I got to the end, I had 6 weeks left to write to finish a book before my manuscript was due. And originally, a lot of the present day material was going to be at the end of the book in a chapter about mapping and all this other, you know. And I called my agent and I said, you know what? I think all this material needs to be threaded throughout the book. And she's like, I think you're right. And I hated when I heard her say that, because then I had to do it. and that was really hard, because then trying to talk about the present when I'm in 1937 talking about the car, that was another whole layer of difficulty. But I made it a better book. And by the end, I was, I don't even know how I wrote that book in 8 months. Even though I had been researching it for, I think, 7 years at that point, 6 years. So it was a crazy experience. I'm just so thankful it's done. Then when I turned it in, I thought, I don't even know if it makes sense, because I didn't have enough space and time to really step away from material.
Well, the threading of the history probably was necessary with, you know, our current day, because of what's happened since 2016. I think, oh, all these horrible elements of our history didn't necessarily go away or stop happening. I think that was confusing and upsetting for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, to me, you know, as a Black woman, it wasn't surprising. I mean, when I first started this project, so many people said to me, like, you know, they were just horrified, because it was when Obama was president. And they said, oh my God, there was a Black Traveler's Guide. Like, they just were horrified that such a thing ever was even needed, you know, and they would say to me, oh, thank God we don't need that anymore. And then Trump got elected and Charlottesville happened and, you know, all those things. And then a lot of those, and these are my well-meaning white liberal friends, yes, would call me up in tears and just say, oh my God, you know, we need another green book and I can't believe this is happening. And, you know, to me and my Black friends, we're like, well, of course, nothing's different. Nothing has changed. You know, to me, it seems like the only big shift in the awareness about the, you know, the truth, it's like the veil has been lifted for everybody else, it seems like, finally. But we've been dealing with this for generations. And none of this is news to us or surprising. I think what has been so devastating to most white folks is the symbolism of America and believing that we live in a free and fair society. I think we can no longer just say that that's the truth. And I think so many people, no matter, you know, even if they saw racism or knew racism existed, they thought the society that they lived in was generally what it proposed itself to be. And now the hypocrisy in that, I think, is so undeniable. And yet it was in the 40s. I mean, that's part of why I wrote the book the way I did. That's why I wrote about, you know, the war and the Double V campaign and, you know, Black soldiers were fighting and losing their lives to, you know, defend these American values in the face of Nazis. And yet they didn't have the same rights that, you know, they were in a similar situation that Jewish people were in Germany. So it was a real, you know, conundrum of how we've been able to continue this narrative of equality and fairness, you know, for all Americans for so long. So to a lot of, you know, I won't speak for the race, for my race, but to me and many of my Black friends, we've been like, well, finally, you know, it just seemed to take forever for people to even acknowledge that there's a problem. So in that way, I'm really grateful that the book came out when it did and that, you know, we've really started to interrogate the policies and the things that have kind of created the you know, country that we live in today. I'm still not very hopeful that there's going to be major change, but what is new is the response and the emotional response to this, to these disparities.
Well, yeah, my fear is we're going to stop thinking about it, which is, I think, as Americans, I think that is the status quo too many Americans are just so eager for, to get to a place where we don't have to think about it, even though, like, that kind of just means giving up on the idea of justice at all.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, to me, I think even most people who may be aware and want change and really believe in equality and fairness, what needs to be done to move the needle in any significant way beyond that pendulum that I keep bringing up in the book that moves back and forth? We can make great strides sometimes in our history, and yet then we fall back. So moving forward doesn't mean a whole lot, especially to Black folks, because we've moved forward before and then we move back. But there's going to have to be, I mean, I always follow Michelle Alexander, you know, the author of New Jim Crow, and her work in terms of mass incarceration. And that's also what my book deals with. I mean, it was really a tall order to bring in the story of mass incarceration to the Green Book and tie that into a book and have it make sense. That was another challenge. I thought, you know, I just don't want people to get to the end and be like, well, what does mass incarceration have to do with the Green Book? But really threading that narrative of, you know, it is very, we have been here before and we do this every 20, 30 years. It's not, and we've done it so often that this is pretty much how America works. It's working, you know, disparities in the things in the system, especially within, you know, the violence that we see with police brutality. The system is working as it's designed to work. Things are not broken. That's the way it is designed. We have to break it so that we can get true, you know, progress. And Michelle Alexander always says, you know, nothing short of a revolution will really make change, real change. We'll keep playing this dance of moving things forward, and then we'll be pushed back. And that's what the you know, book really is about. But beyond our own complicity and our participation within the system to fund the system, to, you know, keep it going as it is, that's on us. And I think as every American, regardless of race, we are participating in it and perpetuating it, even folks of color. So it is complicated.
Well, there's, like I said, you know, there's this wonderful variety of imagery and tones in the book. And, you know, you describe a thriving African-American culture, you know, mid-century. And, you know, we get to learn about the, you know, the Esso and Pullman companies who, you know, didn't seem to have strong racist policies in place, so that they were friendly to African-American workers and were, you know, safe places for them to work. And, you know, what it requires is just people of conscience running things, apparently. But people have to make a choice instead of just trying not to upset white people. But there's a photo, you know, I grew up in South Florida, a little bit in Pompano Beach and a lot in Coral Springs. But, you know, our, the closest herb was Fort Lauderdale. And there's a photo of a lynching in Fort Lauderdale. And it's like, well, 40 years later, like, I may have been at that actual spot. And, you know, this history isn't that old.
Mm-mm. No, I mean, and that's the thing. That's the other, I think, you know, it's funny that we think it was such a long time ago, but of course, you know, listening to Ron's stories obviously puts it out of, it brings it out of the archives and into my family's life. I mean, I knew that theoretically this wasn't, you know, this happened a generation before me. I mean, when I was 7 years, I end the book with my mother riding in the front seat of the car with my mom, watching a prison chain gang in Texas, because I grew up in Texas when I was really young, and asking her, you know, why are all these men chained up? And she's like, well, they're prisoners. I'm like, well, why are they all black? And she said, well, because, you know, she couldn't answer the question, you know, but she just couldn't explain institutionalized racism to a 7-year-old. I was ready to have that conversation. But, you know, how do you, I think we become anesthetized to it. I think we, you know, we see things that are so horrible, and then you just keep, it's with any dysfunctional family or any kind of trauma, anything that happens as humans, we have this incredible ability to adapt and then decide it's just not, you know, it's not as shocking anymore. And I think the ongoing, just real devaluing of Black people's humanity and their lives has just been what we have done so easily and so regularly in this country. And until somebody like George Floyd is, you know, crying for his mother, it hit a chord somewhere, you know, deep in, I think, being what it means to be human. And that's what we keep somehow denying, you know, real access to our humanity. So as a culture, you know, again, I am hopeful that things may be different in terms of the emotional response to the times, but I don't have as much faith that we're going to move the needle in a significant way that's really going to change, because so many people are going to have to give up something or their power or their entitlement to share this power.
Or sense of comfort in their identity.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a white person. Nothing has ever, I have never done anything to contribute, which, like, you know, like, okay, maybe you personally, maybe, although even that's kind of doubtful, but
humans generally don't volunteer that.
No, they don't. And, you know, with, you know, that George Floyd video, for me, you know, part of what makes it so horrible isn't just the despair, but the look on the cop who's staring straight at the camera, filming him going, look at me, I'm doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, defiant. I know that. I'm being on camera doing this. I'm doing it anyway. Yeah. This is my authority. I'm not going to stop at all because I am right, which I don't know how you don't have a lifelong protest after right. witnessing something like that. And, you know, part of what I find fascinating about the Green Book is just, you know, the importance of self-determination. I had this conversation, I'm not going to say with who, but when the subject of Black Lives Matter came up, the problem, as it was described to me, is, well, what are police supposed to do when Black people point weapons at them? And I'm like, that has nothing to do with anything ever to having to do with Black Lives Matter. Like, that has never been, even though that should be a legitimate question as well, but if Black people have weapons, like, they shouldn't be killed either, necessarily. Like, I guess some cases maybe, but that has never even been part of it. Which means with so many...
There's far too many cases where Black people don't have weapons and they're still coming down and, you know, like, tripping out in the street. So,
but the way the NAACP would say take cases, and they would only take cases that to them were airtight. This is clearly injustice. There is no other way to interpret this, because they wanted strong cases to prosecute, or I guess the opposite. But, you know, they wanted strong cases to defend. You know, in the case of a conversation like that... Right. It was really important for African Americans to not rely on moderate white people to help with anything, and instead, you know, have their own conversation and their own culture to try and take care of themselves when it came to traveling this country.
I mean, that's the irony, too, as well as, you know, that, and it's so ironic that now that Black culture has somehow been consistent with this idea that, you know, we needed handouts, or that, you know, that we're not a self-sufficient culture. When we, I mean, integration was a double-edged sword, but the beauty of it was that clearly when we were not allowed to go into white spaces or be a part of pretty much most every space that white Americans could freely roam through in America, we did create our own self-sufficient neighborhoods that had these incredible, there were about 70,000 Black-owned businesses when the Green Book first started, because by necessity, there was no, you know, we needed our own grocery stores, we needed our own, you know, obviously now the Tulsa race massacre is finally getting the, is something that, of course, we knew for many, many, you know, decades, but now it's becoming clear to most Americans, like, what happened. And, but I think it's very symbolic in terms of, you know, there were other parts of, like, little Greenwood districts throughout the country. And a lot of them were housed where these Green Book sites were. You know, they were Black, just Black-owned businesses were vibrant. And throughout the community, there was a sense of community. People traveled and went, tried to find the Black neighborhood because they knew they would be safe. And these businesses thrived. And then urban renewal happened and literally wiped them off the earth. I mean, I would go and scout Green Book sites. I could get to, I got to about 30 a day. I was working 16-hour days, but, you know, I'd go some places and like 10 or 15 of them, or 20 even, would be just wiped out. There'd just be a freeway where the addresses were, right? And with, you know, I think, again, it's not so much that Black folks needed help, quote unquote. We needed to be left alone. We needed to not be bombed.
The biggest gift, you know, yeah, is just leave us
or
alone.
Killed or yeah. I mean, it's just, if they had left us alone, we would have been fine. But it seemed like when Black people did make real strides, that a lot of the backlash for, you know, Tulsa was because it was Black Wall Street. It was a very, you know, shoeshine boys made more money in Tulsa than most people who worked in stores, and some adults who were white. They couldn't allow that to happen. They were very angry that Black people were doing so well. So, you know, it's been it's a hard pill to swallow now to have this history that, you know, kind of thrown back in our face as though we needed help, because during segregation, we didn't. And it wasn't until integration that things really did change. Ron always said, you know, integration was the worst thing that happened to us.
And yeah, this history comes to us thanks to a superhero TV show, which I, you know, better that than nothing, I guess. Yeah, it's, but I also, I don't know, in some ways there are a lot of, the existence and of the Green Book and, you know, the pride of Victor Green and the excellence of the product, like it makes me happy because it's kind of a great story.
Right. The ingenuity and the brilliance of who he was. I mean, he was a man with a seventh grade education. And he was able to basically, he had a simple solution to a pretty big problem. And I think in that way, it does inspire other, when you think of Steve Jobs, right? When he put a camera in a phone, he probably, I'm sure he didn't think that was a revolutionary tool, you know, that was going to change, that was going to trigger a, you know, another civil rights era. So I think in that way, it is very hopeful that there are simple things you can do that can somehow have a huge impact. And Victor Green did that. I'm sure that's not what he set out to do, but that's what happened. And he was just trying to get, he was driving his wife, Alma, to Virginia from Harlem pretty regularly because that's where she was from, and saw that his friend who was Jewish, and they had a kosher guide that he used to travel to the Borscht Belt, to upstate New York. He thought, wow, Black people could probably use a guide of some sort. But Victor Green wasn't the first one. There was, you know, Hackley and Harrison's was the first Black traveler's guide, started in 1930. Victor Green's guide started in 36. And Victor, you know, and there were nearly about a dozen other of these Black traveler guides. So the Green book was so critical because it was published for the longest period of time. It had Esso gas stations distributing the guide. Victor Green was a postal worker, and he had this network of other postal workers throughout the country promoting the guide and, you know, soliciting for advertising. He had this multi-pronged marketing strategy that was pretty brilliant. But again, he didn't have an MBA. He didn't need an MBA to do that. He was just, you know, a brilliant man and was trying to solve a problem. So I feel very... And to support all of these Black businesses, I mean, there were so many different kinds of businesses in the Green Book. It wasn't just travel-related businesses. There were sanitariums and, you know, liquor stores,
banks.
And banks. You know, there were all these things in the Green Book. So it was really, I think, looking back at it and having the opportunity to really study... The Green Book was, it's been the highlight of my life. You know, I'm still working on so many different projects related to the book and to this material. It'll probably be in my life for another decade because it's so rich and we're so new to this history. We just really discovered the Green Book relatively, you know, not that long ago. So it's an exciting, I think, symbolic tool to use in our efforts to make things better. But yeah, and I'm glad that it's inspiring people. We'll see what, you know, what comes out of it.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Candace Taylor, Lisa Pally, Alexander Pate, and Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, The Diaries of a Sawzalled Scribbler as transcribed by Dimitri Cockmey, and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. If you're a regular listener and have not yet done so, please review the show over on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you stream this bugger. If you're going to be using the evil services of Amazon.com for your Christmas shopping, you can do this show a big favor by clicking on the Amazon link on the left-hand side of our homepage. And this show will earn a slight commission off anything that you buy without any additional expense to you. You can even buy books and stuff that way. You could even buy my book, Guy Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame, that way. All right, if I become any more corrupt or greedy, I'll have to become the governor. I better let you go. Until next time, gang, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.